The computer staff at U.S. Leasing were baffled when one day in December 1980, the computers that ran their business began acting strangely. The company's computers were behaving in an unusually sluggish manner, so it was a relief to the computer operator on duty late one afternoon when someone called to say that he was a software troubleshooter working for Digital Equipment Corporation. The slowdown problem, he told the operator, was affecting all of Digital's sites. The situation was so widespread, he said, he wouldn't be able to come in person to fix it. He would have to walk someone through the procedure over the phone. The cheerful technician asked for a phone number for the computers, a login, and a password. He said he would then insert a fix into the system. The computer operator at U.S. Leasing was only too happy to oblige. It was a procedure he had gone through before with Digital. He thanked the Digital technician, who assured him that everything would be back to normal in the morning. But the next morning, the computers were as phlegmatic as ever. If anything, the problem was worse. The computer operator called John Whipple, U.S. Leasing's vice president for data processing, who called the local Digital office in San Francisco and asked for the helpful technician who had called the previous day. There was no employee by that name in San Francisco, so Whipple called Digital headquarters in Massachusetts. Not only was there no such employee on record, but Digital had no plans to make a universal repair. Whipple went straight to the computer room to find the operator. "Someone's been in," he told him. Whipple's only choice, he decided, was to find and destroy any unauthorized accounts, to call everyone who used the U.S. Leasing computers and have them change their passwords. Later in the day, the computer operator had a second call from the technician. He was as friendly as ever, explaining that the fix hadn't taken. "I can't seem to get into your machine," he said in a concerned voice. This time the operator played dumb. "Give me your number and I'll call you back." "I'm not really reachable," came the response. "Let me call you back." When Whipple got to work the next morning, the computer operator was beside himself. The printer connected to one of the computers had been disgorging printouts all night. The floor was papered with them, and every page of every printout was densely covered with type. Covering each printout, repeated hundreds of times, was a spiteful message. "The Phantom, the system cracker, strikes again. Soon I will crash your disks and backups on System A. I have already crashed your System B. Have fun trying to restore it, you asshole." Another read, "Revenge is ours." And finally, in neat rows of type marching across the page, "Fuck you, fuck you, fuck you." Interspersed among the vulgarities were names. Roscoe was one, Mitnick was another. Mitnick. MIT Nick? Could that mean that MIT students had done it? People who were attracted to the computer profession in the 1960s and 70s could hardly be considered flamboyant. By and large, they were technical loners, those who entered the field before the computer industry mushroomed, beckoning thousands of ambitious self-starters with the promise of fortunes to be made, were mostly men like John Whipple. They went to schools like MIT and the California Institute of Technology, and they latched onto computers as an extension of an adolescent compulsion to sit in their rooms and pull radios apart. Others had a simple fascination with math, and computers were just the logical next step. Whipple had been in the computer industry for 20 years, long enough to have witnessed many a harmless prank. MIT students were famous for harmless pranks, but this was no practical joke. These electronic vandals might as well have broken into the room itself, sprayed graffiti all over the walls, and taken a hatchet to the computers. Not only had they plastered printer paper with their malicious messages, they had gone into the files in System B themselves, deleted every scrap of information on inventory and customers and billing notices, and replaced everything with their invective. They had, that is, destroyed the computer's entire database. Whipple ordered both of U.S. Leasing's computers to be cut off from any telephone lines and sealed from outsider access. His chief worry wasn't so much over the lost data, because he also had the information on backup tapes. His main fear was that somehow the intruders had devised a program that would let them back into U.S. Leasing even after all the passwords had been changed, a software contrivance called a trap door. That day, the company's computer operations remained shut down while their computer staff loaded the backups, reconstructed the data, and restored it on the machines. The entire restoration process took 24 hours. After a day, the computers went back online. Although all the passwords had been changed, and the system seemed as secure as it was going to get, Whipple decided he wasn't going to rest until arrests had been made. His first call was to Digital Headquarters. All he wanted was some idea of how the intruders might have broken in at all, and some assurance that it wouldn't happen again. Anyone at Digital, he figured, would sympathize immediately with what Whipple was going through. At the least, he expected a sympathetic ear, and he wouldn't have been surprised if the company dispatched some eager young security expert to San Francisco to take care of everything. But the response he got was tepid, if not cool. Within a few minutes, he was mired in a bureaucratic procedure. In order to have Digital even consider the matter, Whipple would have to fill out a purchase order, then have his supervisor authorize the expense. A purchase order? Some invisible creeps were erasing his data, writing fuck you all over the place, threatening his other computer, and Digital wanted him to fill out a purchase order? This wasn't the reaction Whipple had expected from Digital of all companies. Digital was founded in 1957 by Ken Olson, an individualistic and outspoken MIT engineer. Just as the International Business Machines Corporation was passing the billion-dollar mark in sales of machines that sat behind glass enclosures and processed information in huge batches, Olson set out with $70,000 in venture capital to build a smaller computer that interacted directly with the user. The idea of an interactive computer had come from a pioneering generation of computer researchers at MIT, and one of their early machines became the model for Digital's first computer, the PDP-1. When Digital delivered one of its first computers to MIT, it was installed in a room one floor above an IBM machine. The IBM computer was locked behind two layers of glass. Problems were submitted on batches of IBM cards, and results didn't come until the next morning. The Digital computer was accessible to students any time of day or night. Commands were typed on the keyboard, and the computer responded in a few seconds. A love affair began. Students gathered around and worked on the new computer until 3, 4, and 5 in the morning. The MIT administration even considered removing the Digital computer because people were so obsessed with it they stopped washing, eating, and studying for their classes. And from the beginning, Digital designed its computers to be used in networks. Digital found its large customer base at universities and other research institutions. For the same reasons of accessibility and speed, it didn't take long for Digital computers to gain acceptance among commercial customers, too. The complexity that came with buying an IBM mainframe was often overwhelming for people outside of university and computer science departments. Digital computers provided a package that was as professional as IBM's, but not nearly as complex. Whipple had believed Digital to be a company driven by its customers' requirements. He was surprised and dismayed by the company's response to his request for help. Evidently, the bureaucratic tangle served to mask the true situation. The people at Digital headquarters in Massachusetts wanted nothing to do with the event. So Whipple called the FBI. Three agents arrived at his office the next day. They showed far more concern than anyone at Digital had, but their questions were geared toward trying to figure out whether this was a federal case. There was no doubt that a crime had been committed. There were no federal laws governing computer crime at the time, but if this case fell under federal jurisdiction, it could be prosecuted under federal wire fraud statutes. At the same time, the state of California had a year-old law on the books prohibiting unauthorized access to computer systems. After some deliberation, the FBI decided that, since the break-ins didn't appear to have involved interstate telephone calls, it should be handled by local authorities. Whipple's next call was to the telephone company. He asked Pacific Bell to place traps on the lines. The phone company agreed to do the traces, but that presumed that whoever had committed this act would call again. Whipple had the feeling, even the hope, that these intruders would be arrogant enough to do so. And they were. The call came in the afternoon. This time, the computer operator's object was to keep the technician on the line while a trace was completed.
"I don't know what's going on here," he moaned into the phone, "but everyone's upset."
The operator kept a dialogue going for as long as he could. He cursed U.S. Leasing, saying it had taken away his password, so he couldn't log in to the computers even if he wanted to. Oddly, the friendly technician seemed in no hurry to hang up. With an eerily professional knowledge of the system, he told the operator exactly what to do to bring the computers back online.
Whipple and a phone company employee were listening on another line, and when the operator put the hacker on hold, Whipple could hear two people talking in the background.
"I think they're on to us," one said to the other.
The trace went only as far back as an outbound Sprint port in San Francisco, the electronic doorway of GTE Sprint, then a fledgling long-distance telecommunications company. Using several different long-distance accounts to cover their tracks was one of the phone freak's favorite tricks. Someone wishing to break into a computer could make himself more difficult to trace by first dialing through the equipment of one or even several long-distance carriers before finally calling his target. In every case, false credit card numbers were used. Such a ruse made the phone company's task of completing a trace considerably more difficult. Crossing company boundaries made it easy for freaks to hide behind layers of bureaucracy that slowed law enforcement officials. It took Whipple several phone calls before he finally reached Sprint's security department, such as it was. The security people gave him a number he could call around the clock. If the intruder called again, they told him, he should call the number at once so they could start their own trace. A few hours later, the intruder did call. Again, the unhappy operator kept him chatting, and again the phone company traced the call to the same Sprint telephone number. With the glee of an angler whose hook is securely lodged in the mouth of a prize-winning marlin, Whipple called the number the Sprint security officials had given him. There was no answer. Whipple had never been much of a candidate for confrontation. He was easygoing and low-key, but now he was on the warpath. To arrive at work one morning and see his printer spewing out obscenities and all of the information on one of his computers obliterated was something Whipple had never imagined. He wanted to find out if other digital customers in the San Francisco area had been hit, or did these miscreants have a particular reason for wanting to attack U.S. leasing. That afternoon, he began calling other large digital installations. At least half a dozen others told him they, too, had troublemakers in their systems. One large hospital that had just bought its digital system, didn't even have it fully installed yet, had already been getting repeated phone calls from a digital technician demanding the computer dial-up number and passwords. When the hospital computer manager explained to the caller that the computer wasn't even up and running, the indignant caller demanded to speak with the hospital's chief administrator. Whipple asked the hospital administrator if he would be willing to join him in pressing charges. "No," came the answer. After all, the hospital had been spared any damage, and the negative publicity, he told Whipple, would far outweigh the satisfaction of seeing justice done. Whipple realized that if anyone was going to take up a crusade against these electronic foes, it would have to be U.S. leasing alone. He took the systems down for another day to change everyone's password a second time. He set up the computers to monitor all unsuccessful login attempts. The following day, the computers were back online. By 4 o'clock that afternoon, the intruders were back too, trying without success to break in again. Like insects smacking themselves senseless against a screen at night to get to the light inside, they kept flying at the system, trying password after password. Once again, U.S. leasing immediately shut down all of its outside lines. By this time, the company was buzzing with talk of the intrusions. Whipple was stunned when he met a senior executive in the hallway who chuckled and said, "Maybe we should hire this kid." Whoever was doing this certainly seemed to have more than a passing familiarity with the computer's operating system. In fact, from the commands he was typing, he seemed to know more about exploring its nooks and crannies than Whipple and his staff. But hire such a mean-spirited person? That would be like giving the Boston Strangler a maintenance job in a nursing school dormitory. Whipple's reply to the executive was curt. "How many people will we have to hire to watch him?" As incredulous as he was disappointed, Whipple began to resign himself to writing this off as a colossal, embarrassing waste of energy and time. There wasn't much left to do but count up the losses and try to forget about it. In the end, he figured, the break-in had cost the company $250,000 in lost time and business. The chances of ever catching the creeps who had caused all the headaches were slim at best. A few weeks later, Whipple dropped the matter entirely. Years later, Roscoe and Kevin would claim they had been framed by Susan Thunder, that she had plastered their names all over the U.S. leasing computer in order to pin the break-in on them, while Susan would hold firm to her claim that Kevin and Roscoe had done it.